was a hero in every sense of the word, yet his life was sacrificed for nothing. The one thing that would have given his death meaning is the safety of the Enterprise. Now, you've made that impossible, Mr.
We came here for a specific purpose, Doctor.
Maybe not the same one. I really came here to find out why you stayed and fought.
The captain would have remained to recover a member of the crew at the risk of his own life or even the ship.
Yes, he would, Mr. Spock. But you didn't have that decision to make. What did you have to gain by fighting the Tholians? You could have assured yourself of a captaincy by leaving the area. But you chose to stay. Why?
While there was a chance, I was bound, legally and morally, to ascertain the captain's status.
You mean to be sure if he was dead? Well, you made certain of that.
That is enough, Doctor. We both have other things to do.
This crew is to survive. I have to find an antidote to the space you've locked us into.
You'll return to your duty as soon as we've discharged our responsibilities here.
There's no hurry, Mr. Spock. The antidote probably doesn't concern you. Vulcans are probably immune, so just take your time. Must admit, I don't understand you, Spock. But I just can't believe that you would want Jim's command. But you must know that if you get us out of this situation, they'll pin a medal on your chest and give you command of the Enterprise.
Doctor, I am in command of the Enterprise.
I would like to remedy that situation.
Now, Humbots Destroy.
Welcome back to Humbots Destroy. I say welcome back because we've actually just taken a break from the last episode and we're recording it in the same sitting. For you, it's probably been a couple of weeks. We might even be gone by now. No one will be hearing this.
Well, we could have winked out.
We could have winked out. The universe could have ended. But let's assume it didn't and that we're all still here. I'm Terry DeFellin. I'm joined, as always, by Graham Sibley and Derek Mantle.
Hello.
Hello.
So we're continuing our discussions on the mirror universe, or mirror universes, parallel universes, and the like. This is actually going to be our final discussion in this segment. You know, we'll be talking about other types of episodes going forward. But we're ending with the Tholian Web, and the Tholian Web makes a degree of sense because it has that direct tie back with a specific Mirror Universe episode. More than one, in fact. It's referred to very heavily in A Mirror Darkly, as we know. We discussed that when we talked about that episode earlier on. And also in that one of the Discovery episodes, because it was used as a little plot device to move things forward ever so slightly in the Mirror Saga. There, if you remember, there was the reference to the Defiant. And this is the story of the Defiant, and it's a third season episode. And this also, like last week's episode, the alternative factor, gents, it was also a troubled production, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The director. It's interesting, we've got Alan Ashman's Star Trek Compendium here, and Ralph Senensky is credited as the director. But in fact, it was on the episode, it's Herb Wallerstein.
He did the majority of the directing.
Yeah, I think it's kind of emerging that Senensky did quite a lot of it. Maybe not the majority, but quite a lot of it anyway. And he was sacked after the fourth day or the third day of shooting.
Oh, really? Okay. I heard the reason was because of overrunning.
Yeah, it was overrunning.
And a budget. Budget.
Yes, but Senensky wrote about it some years later on his website, and he said that basically what happened was is those funky environmental suits that they use in the Tholian Web were an absolute pain, and they had to be, the actors had to be sewn into the suits.
Oh, wow.
And they were skin tight, okay. And they were an absolute nightmare, and they caused massive delays in production, which he said were completely beyond his control. And Senensky has directed a number of episodes of Star Trek successfully, and so it's understandable that
so because of visible panty lines they sacked him.
Well, maybe so, but anyway, they lost a whole afternoon's shoot because of that, of it, and because there was a delay in getting those suits ready, and Fred Freiberger sacked him.
Okay.
Said and got
in.
Wasn't
his fault. It's not very. It's not.
Well, he says, you know, he explains. It's on his official website, and he talks about it quite a lot. And you know, he certainly, his side of the story is quite plausible. You know, that it wasn't really anything that was beyond his control. Initially, the plan had been, if you guys remember, to have not environmental suit, but to use a sort of force fieldy kind of thing. They were going to have these belts
like they used in the cartoons. Didn't
indeed,
they?
In the animated series, they did those. Actually go,
which were obviously used because they were made incredibly cheap, and all you had to do was draw a green line around the characters.
A little red wreck line around the characters, and that was that. And I'm assuming that they just thought, no, that looks too expensive. We won't do that.
So they made these really expensive suits that actually were really difficult to use.
And ended up,
But they looked good. Mm. They looked fabulous.
They are
was a wonderful aesthetic.
Fabulous, yeah. But, I mean, there was an opportunity for a famous Star Trek shortcut there.
Yeah.
Basically, they will, you know, put your little belt buckles on and go, bing, and as long as they made a little buzzing sound or something like that, they probably could have got away with, you know, not having any kind of visual effect. And a little bit like what they did with the transport. So, well, we can't afford, you know, shuttlecraft. Yeah, we can't afford to land the ship, so we'll just have a use this sort of like shortcut.
You can actually see them struggling with the actual with the spacesuits.
Yes.
When they're actually on, you know, in the actual episode, they don't actually have much movement.
No,
you know. So,
but I mean, given the circumstances and the constrained budget, I mean, it's Bill Tice, isn't it? Again,
yes.
William Weir Tice. What a designer of the clothes he is. Absolutely sensational. And look really good, and one of the number of aesthetics about that show that are very striking, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. You do get the feeling that the suits are only there so they can make toys out of them. that's probably the reason why they were insisted on being used, because there's no other reason for them to actually be using them. It's not as if they go out walking on the outside of the ship or anything like that.
No, absolutely
it's,
right.
They're all walking around on very familiar scenes. Yeah, you could just say that life support's working, can't you?
Because we also, because when we talked about is there in truth no beauty, we had this, didn't we, where the Vulcan Idik was used, which was also a merchandising thing.
Yeah, so. And it's very, very close in time to that, isn't it?
So, I mean, I'm sure the viewers, I'm sure our listeners are aware of the story of the Tholian web, so we won't recap it. But, obviously, I think there's a couple of notable things about it. One, obviously, the Tholians, very cool.
Yep.
Which we'll talk about in a minute, but also an opportunity to see another starship, which is also really, really cool. And it's always fun to see other starships. I always remember when there were other starships on Star Trek, even though they were exactly the same as that, because they were basically the same model, and indeed the same set. So this is a really clever storytelling device, because it's a bottle episode. It's a 100% bottle episode, but it's also got quite cosmic, because it's got, you know, alternate dimensions, and then it's also got, you know, a hostile alien
which
species,
look very different,
look very different, and it's in that respect, it's good use of scope, good storytelling, but while keeping it really, really nice and cheap.
It is a bottle episode, but they do use space as more than just a backdrop in this, because of the web itself.
Yeah.
Now, the name of the episode, Tholian Web, has always struck me as something, well, it's not really about the Tholian Web. The Tholian Web is just something that goes on during the episode. I always think it's a bit like calling the Galileo 7 a giant who threw spears.
Yes,
it's that mentality. So are they the real thing about this episode is the Defiant disappearing?
Yes,
The Tholians just turn up to be just a little bit of an annoyance.
And it's another Spock episode, isn't it?
Yeah,
we could have paired this up nicely with the Galileo 7.
It is a very
Spock
very,
takes
very
charge
much,
episode.
Yeah.
And now I think this is the thrust of it. I think this is what we've been talking about so far has been, you know, the aesthetics and these visual curiosities. I think what the episode is really about is about Spock and McCoy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And life without Jim.
Yeah.
And the importance that Jim has on their friendship and on each other.
And also on the other members of the crew.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And how keenly his absence is felt.
Yeah.
Explored a little bit in the Paradise Syndrome earlier on in the season. Which is, it will take a long time before we get round to that episode, but really examine quite strongly here, and through the sort of, like, you know, the prism of Spock as he deals with dealing with the command decisions that he makes in this crisis, and how he deals with them by comparison to how McCoy mostly thinks.
This is the thing, it's a third season episode, and the only qualms I have about it, because obviously we've had the relationship between Spock and McCoy all the way through the previous seasons, and I thought by now they would have actually calmed down a bit, but McCoy is even more irritated and more antagonistic towards Spock than usual in this. Obviously, that can be explained because of the actual whole nature of the space there is actually turning people mad.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's sort
of people can act slightly out of character,
yeah,
can't they?
Yeah, you know, but I found it a little bit of a problem because obviously I love the characters so much. The actual, you know, Spock and McCoy and Kirk are, you know, they're friends, you know, to us viewers. Mm. But I found that I don't want you fighting, Dan and Mum are fighting again, you know that sort of thing, you know, and you know,
but it works for the story.
It works for the story.
That's what it is all about, isn't it? And especially when you get the video of Kirk,
yes,
talking on there and basically describing exactly what's been going on for the last 20 minutes since he disappeared.
Bones, Spock. Since you are playing this tape, we will assume that I am dead. And the tactical situation is critical, and both of you are locked in mortal combat. It means, Spock, that you have control of the ship and are probably making the most difficult decisions of your career. I can offer only one small piece of advice for whatever it's worth. Use every scrap of knowledge and logic you have to save the ship, but temper your judgment with intuitive insight. I believe you have those qualities, but if you can't find them in yourself, seek out McCoy. Ask his advice. And if you find it sound, take it. Bones, you've heard what I've just told Spock. Help him if you can. But remember, he is the captain. His decisions must be followed without question. You might find that he is capable of human insight and human error. They are most difficult to defend. But you will find that he is deserving of the same loyalty and confidence each of you have given me.
I listened to a review of this episode where they were critical of the way that McCoy's character was written, and it's a similar criticism to what you've just said, Del, because it's like he's being, the term is gumbified. McCoy often becomes something in order to serve the plot, and that sometimes affects his overall sort of like character arc. And this is understandable because TOS is an anthology series, and so they would often. Maybe they would do that, and maybe that was a bit of what was going on here. But I think if you wanted to be more generous, you could say that there's a degree of grief and loss and shock that's going on here as well, and that we're not necessarily seeing McCoy's best side in this, and he's not coping with it as well as perhaps you might expect him to.
Because there's that sequence after we've lost, you know, Kirk. I mean, they have that ceremony, which is really interesting because, of course, McCoy wants to go to it. And, you know, there's that, you know, that sort of confrontation with Spock where, you know, Spock's basically the captain and, you know, trying to get McCoy to get on and do his duties. But there's this ceremony that's going on, but sort of humanistic sort of, a memorial ceremony. Which is really, I think that's a really good little scene there. Actually.
No, I'm glad you highlighted that scene, yeah, because I watched that and thought, oh yeah, because I mean, this is classic Roddenberry, even though he had very little to do with the show at this point. It is, you know, it's a non-religious ceremony,
yeah,
and Star Trek at this point was very, very humanist, and will remain so for quite some time. So, yeah, that was a nice touch. I thought that that scene with Kirk and his log entry was quite moving, and but I wasn't certain. There was a degree. I thought it was just ever so slightly forced, this confrontation between them, and the angry words that they're exchanging are almost building up, almost as if they're anticipating, sort of like, you know, the, if you like, the teacher to come in and say, "Or are you two kids, you know, you play nice with each other." And so I thought that was a little bit forced. But there's some quite touching scenes in it as well. You know, towards the end, when McCoy is really loses his temper, they're on the bridge, Spock is in the captain's chair. McCoy loses his temper, spins the chair around and confronts him, and then...
Must be this space is getting to me too. I know it's nothing you've done, Spock. I'm sorry.
I understand, Doctor. I'm sure the captain would simply have said, "Forget it, Bones."
Which is a really nice, very, very, very warm sentiment from Spock. Mm-hmm. And then McCoy kind of collapses, and it's all because obviously he's overcome. But there's perhaps an element of, I think that they're trying to convey that he's also overcome with the warmth that has suddenly come from Spock. And there is a moment of true friendship, which is also quite touching.
I think really the whole thrust of this episode is actually more down to the fact that the characteristics of the main characters are laid bare. They're really shown. Really, they are the highlight of this episode, and it really shows that the writers really appreciated the characters and used them to drive the whole story through. If we consider last week's or the podcast or the episode we talked about last time, that was completely devoid of that, and hence there's nothing saving in it at all. With this one, what we got in Tholian Web was we've got one of the best episodes of season three for me anyway, because it holds on to the characters so well, and perhaps that was one of the things maybe they did rely on a little bit too much, was the antagonism between McCoy and Spock. And I think you're right. You think, God, they should calm it down a bit by now, but no, they just dial it up throughout the whole third. Whenever it feels like it's dipping a bit, they just ramp it up again. And that goes all the way through right to the end. And but it is that sort of, there is that play of yin and yang, and usually it's Kirk is the balance of the two characters, isn't it? Even though obviously a lot of the time you can think he's thinking more like Bones, because it's the more emotional way of responding to things rather than the cold logical response that Spock will use.
It's funny that those two characters they dominate the actual episode, but there is a lot of other character pieces there as well.
Oh yeah,
there's some lower deck stuff going on there, isn't there?
Well, we see Uhura's quarters, which is really cool.
We finally get up. Yeah. We're waiting all this time. You've we finally get into Uhura's quarters. Yes, indeed, albeit briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's not much that we can do while we're there, but nevertheless. Yes. I mean, it's interesting, those scenes. I mean, I don't know whether or not there was any... Alan Ashman speculates whether or not there might have been a deliberate intention that it would be Uhura who would see Kirk, because whether or not they were thinking about cultivating some sort of relationship between Kirk and Uhura. But I'm probably more minded to think that they probably thought the different way. I thought, well, Uhura is a woman, and so McCoy is more likely to think that she's just being a hysterical woman.
Well,
strap her to the bed.
Yeah. So what we'll do is we'll strap her to the bed. Play out yet another of my fantasies. It is an interesting touch, and I mean, and obviously Nichelle Nichols is given the opportunity to do something else, and we all enjoy and wear something different. And yeah, she looks well, she looks great. I mean, she looks great.
She has three costumes in the episode. How many characters get two costume changes in an episode?
Yeah. Heady days indeed. Heady days indeed.
And they would say these episodes don't have any budget, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny because I mean, like they really do. I mean, I was reading something about that Ralph Senensky wrote about something else about another episode of Star Trek, and he said he was just blown away by the budget. I mean, like, we look back on it and we think these episodes look so cheap because they were made 50 years ago, and so yes, they do look cheap, but actually they were hugely lavish.
Yeah,
and the production values that were put into them at the time were extraordinary.
I don't think they look cheap actually now. I should wound back to my first experience of this when I was probably about seven, And I have mentioned to you, we had a black and white TV for
you have indeed. Yeah.
And it was actually quite a small TV. But this episode's fondly, I remembered it fondly, mainly not for the characterisation, but for all the visuals of it. Because on a black and white TV, those spacesuits look brilliant because they look silver, and they are silver. You can't see all the colours that are on there.
Right.
But it's like my wife was saying last night, she said, when she watched that episode years ago as well on a black and white TV, she was saying, I thought I watched this in colour. And she didn't, because they had a black and white TV at the time, because it actually transfers over very well on a black and white TV, the way the sets are designed, and that they thought about the whole thing. All this sparseness actually looks really good, but also the sort of the uniforms and the
this is the talent that we've got as well. So it's just not just the money, but also the incredible talent as well. So you've Matt Jeffries, who designs the ships and the, you know, the interiors, and Bill Tice, who designs the costumes.
But all the production designers and costumers would have come from black and white TV.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have cut their teeth in that. So even though they were developing this very bright, garish show to help sell colour TV.
Exactly. Yeah.
But they were still using all the
still in all likelihood a great number of American TV watchers are using black and white TVs and will be for some years to come.
It's like odd transfer period a couple of years ago when people were bringing out HD stuff.
Yes.
But when people were still watching a lot on SD. Yeah.
Exactly.
There was a report this week in the newspaper saying that there are still around 7,000 users in the UK using black and white TVs.
Yeah.
I can actually believe that.
Well, I had a black and white TV up until the 90s.
There's still quite a lot of households that don't have TVs.
Yeah. This is also very true. Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult to
believe. Not just people who don't bother buying TVs.
Yeah, they just don't own them to begin with. Yeah, yeah. I mean, my early... I watched Star Trek in colour first time around, but I mean, when I was a teenager and I was collecting them on VHS, I had a black and white TV in my room and watched a lot of those episodes through my VHS in black and white, and I have very fond memories of them.
I was just going to say about the look and feel of this episode, because and really about the remastered version of it, because I don't know about you, but I think this is one episode they shouldn't have remastered, because this one actually won an Emmy for its visual effects.
First time round.
Mm.
And then when they remastered it, they just got rid of them all. So this is all those award-winning visuals.
Have now been
overtaken with...
Yeah, consigned to the bin. Yeah.
And there's also, because I really like the Tholian ships in the original version.
Because
they're like little crystals.
Yes.
And now they're just...
They're ships. Proper ships. Now. Yeah. Because they've got the back, haven't they, which is like different colours.
Yeah. Love the idea of the web. And
the Tholians, when you look at the Tholian ships, and perhaps this is also maybe you've got lore that's bolted on from other shows, maybe. But the original Tholian ships, as you say, the way that they looked, they almost looked like they were part of the race themselves rather than necessarily.
Yeah.
They didn't look like they'd been built in ships.
Yeah, organic.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, like, what's the name of that race in Babylon 5? The Vorlons.
The Vorlons. Yes.
So there's a little bit. You got that kind of vibe from them. And I agree, once they've remastered them, they look like they were built in shipyards.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit. I'm quite comfortable with the idea of that one actually perhaps, you know, emerging, you know.
Well, the aliens are different as well. I mean, you don't really have many aliens that look very alien in Star Trek.
No, you don't.
Star Trek. And these did.
Yes.
Because, you know.
Proper aliens. You do sometimes, don't you? But at some point we'll do Spectre of the Gun and we can talk about the Melkot there, which is a very fun alien. But it is a rare opportunity to do that. So... Yeah, I mean, despite being a bottle episode, they didn't scrimp necessarily on budget and gave the creatives an opportunity to come up with some really good visual effects. And the web itself, I like the web as a concept, although I sort of looked at it and thought, they're really building it very, very slowly.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Why can't they just very slowly move out of the way? I just, but I just thought, well, don't be a twat. Just, you know, just enjoy it. But I mean, it's
like, no, but you have no look. You like Star Trek. You have to pick these things through. You know, over. I mean, yeah. They should have just basically.
Yeah, so, well, look. You know, we haven't got warp drive, lads. But I mean, we're just gonna very slowly.
Or something.
Yeah, just push ourselves away from all of this.
Yeah, so high-tech weaponry, you know, from the Tholians, and they get...
The Tholians are sort of like, oh, yeah. Enterprise is very slowly getting away. Yeah. What do we do?
It's all style, very, very little substance. Yeah. But, yeah. If you're looking for aesthetic, this is beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
If you're picking apart the story, then...
You're not doing it right. No, but we are here to discuss this episode, so it makes sense to discuss these.
I think the actual general story, the science behind the story, all right, it's about the two universes coming into or overlapping for a little while. I thought that was really cool and so much better than the alternative factor where it's like, you know, oh yeah, there's this universe and there's like a little corridor between it, and this one's antimatter, and if anything touches it, if anything meets its counterpart, everything falls apart. Yeah, okay. I mean, in the alternative factor, the science talk was just meant to be deliberately baffling and confusing.
Yeah.
In this one, actually, they actually describe something that you say, yeah, okay, I can go along with this. Yeah,
but there's
this
also an elegance in the dialogue as well, how it's explained to us and to each other.
Exactly.
That is just not there in the alternative factor.
Yeah, I mean, that's why this works so well. And I thought when they're actually on the Defiant, and it's always lovely when they go over to other ships, because it's very much like a Doomsday Machine, isn't it? When they go, the change of the lighting, the ship, you can see you're on someone else's ship. But then there's that great sort of gothic-y moment when everything starts going a bit hokey.
It becomes real
gothic horror.
That's the bit that gets me.
Yeah, when he touches that body on the floor and his hand just goes straight through it, it's brilliant. It's really, really, really good.
Do you remember,
and that really sells the whole episode.
I always have, again, this is the other thing that I always remember, it being quite scared about that, because it did feel like, because everyone's going mad, the idea, and they're killing each other.
Yeah.
And the thing is, a young mind, then you think that how barbaric that is, because they're not killing each other. Like, you might have a couple of phases there, but
hands around their necks.
Yeah, there's a horrible bit where the captain's on the ground with his neck over like that, and the blokes, you know, they're in that death grip, and that is a really horrifying bit. Because do you remember the film Event Horizon?
Yes.
Because that would always, you know, obviously in Event Horizon, it's the same sort of idea with the whole crew sort of slaughter each other, you know, and I find Event Horizon is a very good horror film. It's a brilliant horror film, and I always think back to that, and that's the one that sort of, there's a relationship to this because of that sort of horror on the Defiant and then on the Event Horizon. You know, and they could have turned it, it's got quite a few bits to it. It is a complicated episode. There's lots of really good writing in this.
Yes, yeah, no, there is. This is Judy Burns,
yeah,
and Chet Richards, if memory serves.
Yeah, Judy Burns was only 21 when she wrote this episode.
Really?
Wow. Right. And this was her first work for TV.
Right.
And you can see real talent there.
Yeah, yeah.
And she goes on, she has a great career now over the next 20 years of writing and producing a lot of really popular shows. She did quite a few shows on TJ Hooker.
Did she?
Magnum. She's an episode of Airwolf in there as well.
Ah.
That can't all be great. Wonder Woman. So all those sort of like big sort of like shows. Yeah. $6 Million Man. Yeah, all those sort of...
And this is an early... Was it her first one?
This was her first one.
First one.
It was her first credit.
It's quite the episode to start off with then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Goodness me. Yeah, that is impressive. Yeah. I think that she's... I think that there are inconsistencies a little bit in the plot. I think when Spock fires upon the Tholians and the action, then he's taken to task for that decision, and I never quite get that they're quite certain whether or not he did the right thing or the wrong thing, or even at times I don't think you know what he actually did do in this, and there seems to be just that little bit of confusion in the earlier stages in there.
I wonder if that's more of a question of the fact that they will question him but they won't question Kirk.
But that's what they Yeah, that's completely what they're trying to do.
Yeah,
yeah. But I think actually the dialogue is a little bit clunky, and I was a bit confused in saying, well, I mean, he waited until the last possible moment, and then he took this decision. And I don't think there was anything more that he can do. And in fact, he was vindicated by that, because you know there was the right, that turned out to be the right thing to do. But then there was times in there where people seemed to be suggesting, where the script was suggesting that it was the wrong thing to do, when in fact it was probably actually the right thing to do. And I think that that's sort of like things like that tend to stick with me when I think about this episode. I also feel that it's a little bit thin. I think the kind of the third act of the episode, there's an awful lot of not a lot going on, apart from just a lot of arguing going on, yeah. And there's not a lot of movement, because we're obviously waiting to the climax where Bones inevitably finds the cure, and the Tholians are very slowly closing up their web, and then Jim is next due to appear so that they can try and fish him out.
Yeah.
Now that they realise that he's not dead, and that just for me just seems to take a little long. It goes on a little bit too long.
The escape from the web and actually bringing Kirk back is all over very, very, very quickly.
Yes.
And without too much feeling of jeopardy about it. Let's escape. Okay, right,
yeah,
we're
out. Yeah. But I mean, you could say that actually that's not the whole point of the story. The point of the story is that Spock is going on a journey here.
Yes, indeed.
Spock and Bones are going on a journey here, where Spock is trying to win the respect of the crew as captain, while at the same time trying to stop, you know, his nutty mate from like stopping him from doing his job and all of that, and we get that. We actually, the climax of that particular story comes on the bridge just in Spock's quarters, when Bones has the antidote. There's this great scene with that's a point.
I was waiting for you to get to this.
Scotty,
you're pissing it up.
So Spock, like, they're in Spock's quarters. Spock's going, right, this is what we need to do, lads. Right, you need to make sure that you're ready for this. Full power at this point, not a second more, not a second later. Can you do that? Yep, no worries. Comes Bones, right? Puts down this big decanter full of liquor.
Orange juice.
Yeah. So this is the stuff that's going to cure us. Off we go. And Scotty goes, does it mix well with scotch? Yeah, maybe. Right, I'll let you know. And he leaves. He takes it with him. And I'm watching him go.
He goes on the bender. He's sort of like, oh, they're pissing it up.
For a moment, I'm in the room going, are you going to engineering, or are you going to get wankered in your quarters on your own again?
Yeah.
Well, I assume he goes to engineering, but that was a weird.
So he's half cut.
Yeah. I think basically, well, if this plan doesn't work, I'm gonna get wasted.
He reminds me a bit of that by any other name sequence. Yeah. And he's sort of like there. He seems to exist outside of time. And he's just been getting heavily drunk with this guy. That was good. But I mean, it followed immediately by a very touching scene of reconciliation between Bones and Spock, when they drink a toast and all of that, and that's quite good. And then on the bridge, you know, the bridge crew is all back, everyone's cured, and Spock comes around and he says something nice to Uhura and he says something nice to Chekhov, and there's this lovely moment of camaraderie and togetherness, and then they go about the fairly rudimentary task of putting everything back together again and getting out. And those Tholians going, we really do need to build a faster web, lads.
I think you can look at it and think, oh my god, isn't it a lot more interesting with Kirk in control? Because when he comes up with solutions, there's a lot more drama about them sorting it out.
Yeah.
But no. When Spock's in charge, no, it's all right. Everything's clear. It's really, really
exactly. That's fine. Yeah. Ready, steady, go. Boom. Yeah. That's right. None of this, you know, gentlemen, I suggest you beam me aboard. I'll beam aboard first and we'll do it from there. Okay, no problem.
Yeah.
I'll figure out a way of doing it remotely. So, yeah, cool. Where else are we going with this? Anything else we've got to say about this?
Well, the last sequence, actually, when you have Kirk in the command chair, and then McCoy and Spock sort of like
pretending
that they hadn't seen his last message and all this sort of stuff. I thought it was good,
yeah.
But obviously, sort of
number of views one.
Yeah. You know, but like Spock lying again, basically.
Yeah.
Spock and
why? Yeah, it's like.
Why would you say, we read them, so you could do the
happy music.
Yeah, we need a gag. Yeah. We need a gag at the end.
Let's
of
get
it.
The gag. Like,
oh, do we have to have a gag? I don't know. It's just like say, oh, no, it was fine. We were a bit rocky at first, but we got on all right. Yeah. Oh, great. Okay, so no gag thing. No gag. Fine.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the beginning, actually. I was actually thinking about Chekhov, because Chekhov did a lot of screaming in this.
Mm.
You know, he is a good screamer, isn't he?
Yeah.
Chekhov! Chekhov!
Yeah, we get crazy Chekhov again.
Yeah, we do for a bit, yes.
We also get crazy. It's the deadly years we have crazy Chekhov, don't we?
Yeah.
Do we get... And maybe a bit in...
Day of the Dove.
Day of the Dove, of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we do have. Yeah, he does. He's very good at, you know, going psycho, isn't he?
Yeah. He's like yeah.
When
he's
on his
sometimes
CV.
He looks a bit like
his mop top gets a bit unruly. And yeah. Like, yeah.
I mean, I always liked Chekhov. I always enjoyed his character because I don't know why, but I just knew that even though he does very little,
mm-hmm.
and I always find it quite a treat when we get like more Chekhov-y kind of episodes. But yeah, so. I mean, let's just dwell ever so slightly on this concept of, because obviously what happened then is that the Defiant disappeared and then went into the Mirror Universe. So this is an official Mirror Universe episode.
Well,
we didn't know it at the time.
It's been retconned into being.
It has.
Going back in time.
They went back we went into the Mirror Universe, but into a different time period. And was captured by the Tholians in Tholian space, and the hijinks ensued from there. And if you want to find out what happened, then you can watch In a Mirror Darkly.
I still have problems with it going back in time, though.
Yeah.
Why?
You know. Why?
You know,
it's another dimension.
I know. I still have it. Just still doesn't sit with me well because obviously they've done it for the Enterprise. I suppose it was that period of time with the Enterprise, and they were doing retconning every single thing, you know. And even though I actually do like those Enterprise episodes with the Mirror Universe, I thought they were good. But you know, I did explain last time that this is going back a couple of our episodes with the original idea of Manikota. He was actually going to send Kirk from the
We talked about that last time.
And that would have made more sense, or would it? I don't know. But I just, you know, it is Star Trek, and we do love Star Trek, and it can do what the hell it wants. But I still have, you know, it's sort of.
So it is interesting how, you know, that episode has now sort of like found itself part of that kind of Mirror Universe saga, and places it in canon, if you like, as an official Mirror Universe episode. Albeit, again, retconned, and only a very, very small part of what is a much, much broader episode and an exploration of some much loved characters, which is pretty enjoyable, and for its visuals, if nothing else, is a classic and leaves behind something of a legacy as well. So an important episode of Star Trek. Is there anything else you guys have that you wanted to mention?
I just wondered about the Tholians' ships. You know, we were talking about the original ships, those crystal sort of shaped ships. Did they ever reuse them anywhere in any other episodes?
Well, you are running out of episodes of Star Trek. This is third season,
so they never actually
appear again.
I mean, if they got commissioned for a fourth season, I wouldn't mind betting that footage would have been repurposed somehow. We might have seen the Tholians again in season four, because they'd have gone, it's an opportunity to reuse some visuals.
The Tholians are mentioned, they get a mention in Turnabout Intruder, but that's it.
Oh, well done for remembering something like that.
It is a callback when Kirk's in Leicester and he's trying to...
Leicester, yeah. When did he move to Leicester?
Janice Leicester.
Janice Leicester, He's not in a bay, he's not buried in a car park. Yeah, well, when he is Janice Lester.
Yes. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
and he's trying to convince them that and then he tells them about the Tholian incident.
The Tholian incident, okay.
That's the only callback, I think.
Okay.
And we only see them again in Enterprise as well, which is a little bit of a surprise. I wonder if we might see them in Discovery or going forward, because they are cracking species.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's like the 700th episode of Star Trek, wasn't it, that one, I think?
Was it really
live action? Right. Or some ridiculous number like that.
I don't know if they turn up in the animated series or not, but I mean, they are obviously difficult to do from an effects point of view. But yeah, I think we live in a world now where they can easily be brought back.
Yeah,
and hopefully we'll get to see some Tholian. They live on in the original fiction. There's quite a lot of Tholian going on stuff. It
works well in Britain.
Very very low budget. And so fingers crossed we'll see some Tholians in the future, because they are really, really good. All right, guys, I'll tell you what, why don't we go to the pub and then go and watch some football? Okay then. Well, thank you very much, listeners, for listening to Who Pods Destroy. And from myself, Terry, and from Derek and Graham, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.